Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
In this hour,
how did the U.S. become a permanent national security state, and how has that affected our democratic process?
Then,
did the sexual counter-revolution polarize American politics?
But first,
what are the life chances of children of incarcerated parents? Some call the modern age the incarceration generation. Tough on crime laws and stiff sentencing procedures have contributed to higher and higher incarceration rates in the U.S. Over the past three decades, the rates have multiplied. In fact, for today's children, chances of having a parent in prison is at its peak, especially for poor African-American children. And studies show that their chances of breaking the cycle is increasingly difficult. With a host of emotional struggles and depression, low self-esteem, these children frequently face greater likelihood of homelessness, social isolation, violence, and other obstacles for their futures. Christopher Wilderman joins us now. He is a professor of sociology and a scholar at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. He's authored three papers about these risks. Welcome, Christopher Wilderman.
Thanks, Maria.
Great to have you with us. I think I want to start with the statistics. You compared 1978 to 1990 and the chances that children have of having a parent imprisoned.
Yes, I did.
Why don't you give us a brief overview of that?
So the basic idea behind that paper was just that African-American children were not only much more likely to experience the event than white children were, but also that there was a huge increase in those risks. And I think the core finding from that paper is that about 1 in 4 African-American children could expect to have a parent imprisoned at some point by the time they were 14 years old, while for African-American children whose parents didn't finish high school, about 1 in 2 could expect to experience that risk.
And go ahead.
Oh, and the risks were tremendously lower for white children who had about a 1 in 40 chance of experiencing that event.
And I think given what we know about the incarceration rates for African Americans, it's not surprising about the parental factor, the risk of having a parent being imprisoned at some point. But I think the other findings that are really significant that we should be talking about is, of course, the impact that it's having on these kids in the long term for their health, their well-being, their life expectancy, and also the possibility of them not repeating the footsteps of parents. So let's talk about some of these things. There are three things that you ultimately looked at: infant mortality, homelessness, and aggressive behaviors. Also, there's something on dropping out of school as well, I believe. I don't know if that was in your paper.
That wasn't in my paper, but I can provide a quick summary probably.
Well, why don't we start with, why don't you choose which one you want to start with? Infant mortality, homelessness, dropping out, and aggressive behaviors.
I'll start with the physically aggressive behaviors bit because I think that's sort of what criminologists have been fixated on for 30 years or longer. It's just this sort of idea that crime and incarceration are passed down through families. And what the study finds is that there's a substantial increase in the levels of physically aggressive behaviors of boys who have a father go to prison between around age 3 and around age 5. And I think what this calls us to think about is that these were kids who already sort of were exposed to a host of other forms of disadvantage, you know, likely to be poor, likely to have parents who had relatively low levels of educational attainment. And, you know, even in addition to sort of the effects of those risk factors on their physically aggressive behaviors, you see that paternal incarceration also sort of further increases their levels of physical aggression at age 5.
Do you think that it is actually the incarceration factor or that it is the absence of the parent being there?
You know, it's a really good question, and Sarah Wakefield's work really touches on this in an excellent way. But I think my best sense is that it's not just the absence of the parent, but it's also sort of the trauma of a parent sort of cycling in and out of the system. It's not like something like divorce, where your parents divorce and there's this, you know, period where they were together and then they're separated and then you're navigating that. It's more like your father's in for a year and a half, he's back out for 6 months, he's back in, he's back out. It introduces all this instability into kids' lives that something that only happens once doesn't necessarily do.
The other question that it raised for me as I was looking at this is whether or not it impacted if it was a violent crime or if it was a nonviolent crime that the parent was imprisoned for, and if that impacted the aggressive behavior.
It's a tricky issue, and I think people have speculated about that for a long time. Well, there are two interesting things that I find that sort of have to do with this. One is just that if there was domestic violence in the household, it actually looks like paternal incarceration substantially decreases kids' physically aggressive behaviors. And if it was a violent crime, it looks like effects are relatively small, but it's difficult to tell. So it does seem plausible that effects are concentrated among nonviolent offenders, both within the household and also outside of it.
And then infant mortality. Talk about that and connect that to incarcerated parents.
I'll probably just talk about homelessness along with that, because I think these speak to the same sort of basic issue. So usually when academics and folks like that talk about effects of parental incarceration on kids, the fact that these kids are already really disadvantaged is an obstacle to figuring out whether it was incarceration or, as you mentioned earlier, you know, crime or other hosts of disadvantage that are causing these poor outcomes for kids. And I guess the reason that something like infant mortality or homelessness are interesting are because these are events that we think of very few kids as experiencing at some point, and indeed relatively few kids do. But for families that we think of as maybe sort of hanging on by a thread, we might expect the experience of parental incarceration to compromise that child's care arrangements in a way that could increase risk of infant mortality, or to mean that they no longer have a place to live, that their sort of household is in upheaval as a result of this event. And what you find in the two papers is that having a parent incarcerated does about double the risk of experiencing homelessness for at least one day in the last year, you know, sleeping somewhere that you wouldn't usually sleep, like a car. And that it also increases the risk of infant mortality for kids by about 35%.
Those are pretty high numbers, very high numbers. One of the other things that you have said, both in your papers and I believe you were quoted in the New York Times about this, is you called this a distinctively American phenomenon.
Mm-hmm, I did. What I mean to say by that is just that no longstanding Western European democracy incarcerates people at nearly the rate that we do here. And so what that means is that just like something like homelessness or infant mortality, incarceration is an incredibly uncommon event in a child's life that's restricted to only the most disadvantaged and likely only the most criminally active. Whereas here in America, you can have, you know, 25% of African-American kids experiencing that event. So even though it's not distinctively American in the sense of we're the only people who do it, we're the only people who do it on such a large scale that it could have really important implications for intergenerational inequality and sort of stratification.
And finally, before we let you go, one of the things I thought was really an important factor that you wrote about is that when people, policymakers, are considering the cost and the benefit and doing those kinds of analyses, they're not looking at these other costs to society, including, you know, children's lives who are dying in infancy, and all of the future problems that are occurring. So why don't you say a bit about that?
Yeah, well, I think this fits into a sort of broader research area that focuses on the effects of incarceration on inequality more broadly. And so you see sort of effects of incarceration on health. A really interesting paper came out that looks at the effects of incarceration on HIV/AIDS infection rates and finds really substantial effects. And I think the hesitancy to think about a lot of these factors stems in large part to the fact that people think that these people who end up in prison are bad parents, are bad citizens, and that having them removed from society ought to be a benefit in terms of removing sort of someone who's criminally active from society, but also someone who's not contributing in any sort of tangible way. And I think it's a real oversight, although it is very difficult to try to quantify a lot of these things. That's a lot of what policy comes down to.
Well, Christopher Wildermann, it's really a pleasure having you. Thank you so much for your work and for joining us here.
Thanks for having me.
Christopher Wildermann is a professor and a scholar at the University of Michigan. Do You are listening to The Scholar's Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Before World War II, the U.S. did not have a permanent security bureaucracy. Although it did engage in war, the nation disbanded its war apparatus every time a war ended. But that all changed after World War II. That's when the nation built up its security to become a permanent national security state with a vast bureaucracy, including the CIA, FBI, National Security Council, National Security Agency, Atomic Energy Commission, Navy, Army, Air Force, multiple programs, and a huge and growing budget. This had major consequences and power to shape public policy from the outside of the electoral democratic process, according to our next guest. Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and an award-winning author of numerous books, including On Capitol Hill, Taxing America, and his latest, Arsenal Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. So welcome to The Insiders, Julian Zelizer. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So this book of yours, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism, you're talking about how the U.S. has developed over time this national security state, but it wasn't always this way. Give us some background on this.
Yeah, it's amazing that it took America a long time to develop kind of a full national security system, meaning from a military that was capable of, you know, fighting wars abroad on a regular basis, to things like the CIA, which collects intelligence and conducts secret overseas missions. It's not until the 40s and 50s that we have this, the 1940s and 50s. Before that, really, the country relied on an ad hoc approach to war. When we went to war, we quickly assembled an army. We quickly put together whatever weapons we needed. But then after the war, we dismantled everything. It was a country that was willing to go to war, but was uncomfortable being on permanent wartime footing.
You know, I thought it was interesting the questions that you posed toward the beginning of the book, particularly about what the impact of having this kind of permanent security state, what the impact of that is on the democratic process itself.
Well, it's been a source of trouble for many Americans because essentially what we have created is a system that is not always accountable to the public. National security policymakers enjoy a degree of freedom in terms of making decisions. We have defense contractors who can receive money from Congress, and they're not always reviewed, and it's very hard to kind of take contracts back from the people who produce weapons. So on that respect, there was a tension. But it was also a tension because, you know, ultimately we have a very partisan political system. We have midterm elections, presidential elections, and somehow we had to make our national security decisions in this kind of a system. It was impossible to fully insulate these kind of decisions. So we've had this very contentious history that I try to investigate over how to best protect this nation.
And I want to get into some of that history in a second, but I want to see if you had a sense. I know you're primarily a historian, but do you have a sense of how much impact on decision-making, well, I guess what Eisenhower sort of referred to as the military-industrial complex has had, especially lately?
Yeah, I mean, there's some people who say it has kind of total control over our decisions, meaning it's this picture of a secret group of defense contractors and congressmen who depend on them and administration officials who literally will decide whether to go to war as a way to feed this complex, to make sure it still gets money and that it serves a purpose. I don't exactly believe that's the case. I think, you know, defense contractors have a lot of influence in making sure that military budgets essentially stay the same or that we spend money sometimes on weapons that are not necessarily the best ones. But ultimately, I think politicians respond much more to other kinds of political pressures when they're trying to make these decisions.
You cited quite a few political scientists towards the end of your book, such as Harold Laswell, who talked about the garrison state and was warning about, you know, the supremacy of the soldier or the supremacy of force becoming the status quo. You also mentioned C. Wright Mills. But then there are also all these other complex factors that you say have gone into these decisions, including things like the business community wanting to grow their own businesses from overseas. Talk about that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's many times in the 1940s, the late 1940s, the Marshall Plan, the United States sends money to Western Europe to try to rebuild the continent after it had been ravaged by war. One of the reasons is we think that if we can build strong capitalist economies, it will help protect the area from communism, but also business sees an interest. These are huge markets, and business is very interested in having them open, making sure they are capitalist and not under communist control. Another example is during the early 1970s, there is a whole debate over liberalizing trade with the Soviet Union. Some conservatives oppose this. They want to insist that if we have full economic trade with the Soviet Union, they have to let more Jewish refugees leave the country, for example, and abide to human rights principles. But many business leaders are not as interested in that, and they see opportunities to trade with countries in Eastern Europe. And business played a very big role in the policy that we call détente, which was, again, easing relations in the 70s with the Soviet Union.
You also talked in the earlier part of the book especially about the Asian and Latin American markets and this kind of imperialism that was also linked in with progressive impulses.
That's true. It was very at the turn of the 20th century during the progressive era, which is kind of when America starts to really get an expansive vision of what our role should be in the world, and Americans start to become more comfortable with the idea that we have to be involved. There's many factors behind that, but one of them are economic factors, and there's a real drive by business to make sure that certain markets, whether Latin America or even Asia, remain open and out of the control of adversaries, and this becomes one of the reasons there's support for greater military intervention overseas.
So in some ways, it seems like a lot of the military have been used not so much for defense, but for economic purposes.
That's true. I think a lot of politicians see the two as the same, meaning the protection of markets overseas is, in fact, in our national security interest. This was an argument that has been made. Bill Clinton in the 1990s made this argument that the best way to create peace or avoid military conflict, at least, is to make sure that markets are open and that markets spread, because ultimately that's the best guarantor against war. And this is an old idea, and we've seen it throughout the 20th century. So the politician says they're the same rather than one over the other.
It's interesting because it sure doesn't seem to have worked so well.
Right, and there's plenty of examples in the book where this leads to military interventions that are not necessarily in the best interest of the country, just as other kinds of political pressures often lead to bad decisions.
The other thing I thought was quite interesting was the role of race in eugenics and many political leaders who just looked down on other ethnic groups.
Yes, again, if you go back to the progressive era with presidents like Teddy Roosevelt, they often legitimated why America should get involved in countries like the Philippines when there were many opponents of that here in the United States. They said that these were kind of lesser people and that America had a role to go into countries like this and civilize them by controlling the territory and by implementing programs that would make them more like the West. And you see this kind of argument in different varieties through a lot of the 20th century. It was often used in discussing Asia between the 1940s and 1960s, the idea that ultimately a U.S. presence in those regions could create uplift and create a kind of stronger civilization based on the idea that somehow different Asian populations were inferior to Western civilization. And we still see it today, you can say, in some of the debates that go on about intervention in Arab countries. It's kind of how racial bias often plays an important role in our rhetoric of what America should do overseas.
So then when you tracked how this national security state, the permanent military and all of the bureaucracies that went with it, really got established, you mark that it really got its footing in World War II and then grew from there. If you were going to say what the biggest growth periods were, what would you say they are?
definitely the late 1940s. Let me change it. From World War II, the early 1940s to the late 1940s, that decade of the 1940s is the pivotal period. Starting with World War II, in 1940, Congress passes the first peacetime draft. Before we go into the war, we finally put into place a draft that will last until 1973. Huge increase in how much we spend on the Army, Navy, and Air Force, to, in the late 40s, the creation of agencies like the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Council. It's during this decade we create the system that we essentially still have today. The second major period, you would have to argue, is since 9/11, with the reorganization of Homeland Security into a centralized government body, with the expansion of surveillance programs for counterterrorism purposes. That's the second period. But the 40s, I still think, is the most dramatic, and it's kind of the turning point where we move from one period in American history to the other, much more than 9/11. And I still think we're living in the shadow of those decisions.
And then you talked also about this new influence. Well, maybe not so new. Maybe this has been going on also since the Republic was formed, and that is the role of various interest groups.
Yes, interest groups are very important in politics, certainly since the 1940s in national security politics, and in different ways. I mean, kind of one area you see interest groups are people from a certain nationality, a certain religious background, or a certain political persuasion, pushing for certain kinds of national security decisions. So in the late 1940s, one example is you had liberal organizations. There was one group, the Americans for Democratic Action, who were kind of pro-New Deal liberals, but they were also often the lobby behind a lot of our Cold War policies. They believed America needed to have a vibrant fight against communism. You also had many Eastern European groups who were putting a lot of pressure on U.S. policymakers to fight against Russian Soviet control of Eastern Europe. So throughout American history, there's often different kinds of interest groups. You also have military contractors who we talked about. They form interest groups in Washington that lobby for the continuation of their funding. So the point is that national security politics is not as different from other kinds of domestic politics as we'd like to think.
Yeah, and you even mentioned towards the end the Walton Mearsheimer research that was done into the AIPAC and Israel lobby.
Exactly, and that's an argument I don't necessarily agree with. I mean, they have a very singular focus, saying that the lobby that exists, to promote Israel has singular dominant influence in American politics. And first, I think that ignores the power of many interest groups that exist during this period, fighting for often very different political objectives. But they also tend to downplay the power, again, of other kinds of political forces, like midterm elections and elections on shaping political preferences. But it's still a very kind of powerful argument that I think some subscribe to.
So if we were going to walk through American history as you have done through this book and go through each period as presidential terms, for example, and look at what the big changes in each of them were, what if we started with somebody like Woodrow Wilson?
Well, Woodrow Wilson is hugely important in really articulating the idea about the need to have America on permanent national security footing. Even though it won't happen until later, it's during World War I that Woodrow Wilson starts to get the country more comfortable in some ways with this idea. He has a huge mobilization for World War I that includes everything from the draft that is eventually dismantled to even PR and public relations programs here in the United States. And I think Wilson was a turning point in that respect. He's also a turning point, and we forget this, that it was an incredibly partisan war. Republicans are furious with Woodrow Wilson by 1918 during the midterm elections, right in the middle of the war, when Wilson attacks Republicans and tells voters, vote Democratic or else the war effort will be in trouble. And Republicans just accuse him of making a partisan issue of the war. And it will all kind of collapse by the end of the war. Republicans won't support the League of Nations. It's kind of disastrous, but it's, I think, a nice place to start to remember that the myth of politics stopping at the water's edge has never really been the case, and we see it from that formative moment.
And then if you were going to keep going and looking at the following presidents?
I think FDR in World War II is hugely important because after that, for the next two decades, there'll be a liberal coalition behind a certain philosophy about how we handle national security. I call it liberal internationalism, meaning a belief in multilateralism, a belief in the use of economic assistance, not just military power, and also a kind of belief that we do have to fund a permanent national security state. And it's also during Harry Truman, I would say, is the next key period when you see the emergence of a new kind of conservatism on national security. People like Richard Nixon, who start to set up the arguments about Democrats being weak on defense, that will last through today.
And then if we were going to fast forward a bit and look at the more current days, Reagan?
Reagan, I would just interject, in the middle was Lyndon Johnson, who
sends
the troops into Vietnam, responding in large part to political fears that if he didn't appear tough on national security, conservatives would really undermine his great society and undermine his presidency. But his decision ultimately destroys the liberal coalition that FDR put together. Democrats are fighting among themselves, and it creates a window for conservatives and Republicans to retake power and to really gain a strong hold on this particular issue. Reagan is important, obviously, because the Cold War ends under his watch, or it starts to end. He's a fascinating president because he starts as a Cold War hawk, someone who says we can never negotiate with the Soviet Union, who staffs his administration with people who were adamantly opposed to arms negotiations. And yet, in 1985 and 86, when Mikhail Gorbachev emerges in the Soviet Union and represents this voice of reform, Reagan breaks with conservatives and many Republicans who think this is a bad idea and takes the opportunity to negotiate an arms accord. So kind of Reagan in terms of the Cold War ending is important, but also in terms of a president who was able to cut up against a political pressure to make this important decision.
Although he did really build up the arms in a way that presidents before him hadn't done, in Star Wars
Absolutely.
And that sort of thing.
He also is kind of a post-Vietnam president in terms of period where you start to see some of the rebuilding of support, political support, for a national security system that had been under fire since the 1960s and 1970s. So from increasing military spending dramatically in 1981 and 82 with Secretary of Defense Cap Weinberger to simply his kind of ideological support for soldiers and for the military, Reagan is important. But on the other hand, he didn't feel free to do anything. Reagan was still very much a post-Vietnam president, and that he realized many Americans were kind of leery of war and nervous about long-term military commitments.
Well, Julian Zelizer, it's been really a pleasure to have you. The book is called Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. One final question, and that is, did you find that once they established, the U.S. established this kind of permanent security state, that it has just consistently grown?
Yes, absolutely. One thing about the national security system is it's very hard to cut down for many reasons, from the kind of political pressure against appearing weak on defense to, like all programs in government, once they're there, people become used to them and it's hard to retrench them. But one thing that's true is we've seen a pretty steady growth other than the 60s or 70s in a lot of these programs. And I think President Obama's presidency, we're seeing that a lot of what was put into place after 9/11 will remain permanent. And despite a campaign that was about change and reform, he's very much operating in the system President Bush put together. And I think there's been much less change than many people expected.
So do you think Dwight Eisenhower was right to warn the U.S. about the military-industrial complex?
Yeah, he was right. And again, though, I mean, the only place I think we remember it wrong is he wasn't just talking about interest groups. He was talking about what he faced in his presidency, which was incredible political pressure from Democrats at the time to spend a lot of money and attacks that he was weak on defense. And he was frustrated by 1961 that our electoral system, our party system, didn't create room for people who were not hawkish. And that's very much a kind of forgotten part of what his address was about, and I think it's equally relevant and something that still operates today.
Thank you so much for being with us, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
Again, the book is called Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Did the sexual counter-revolution polarize American politics? Stay tuned. Hello and welcome back. You are listening to The Scholar's Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Have conflicts about sex, women's rights, women's roles, and gay civil rights polarized Americans into irreconcilable warring camps? Our next guest says they have. Nancy Cohen charts the birth of the sexual counter-revolution and its climb to power with her new book, Delirium. Nancy Cohen is a historian and visiting scholar at UCLA. She's authored several books, including The Reconstruction of American Liberalism from 1865 to 1914, and the one we're discussing now, Delirium. Welcome, Nancy Cohen.
Hello, Maria. Thanks for having me here.
One of the things I found striking about your book is the changes that occurred specifically in the Republican Party. A couple of the leaders of the past you noted, Barry Goldwater, supported women's right to abortion and some version of gay rights. Give us the historic sense of Republican leadership in terms of these specific personal and sexual issues.
Today's Republican Party is not your mother's Republican Party. The Republican Party used to actually be the party of small government and personal liberty, and it was far superior to the Democratic Party on women's rights. Some Republicans like Barry Goldwater, when gay rights started to come up in the 90s, was as good as you can be on it. He was co-chair of the Committee for the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. What happened is that in the 70s, in reaction to the sexual revolution, feminism, and gay rights, a group of reactionaries, surprisingly mostly women, organized to turn back the clock. And they went up against the Equal Rights Amendment and they defeated it. They actually fought against federally funded childcare and they defeated that too. They were the ones that ran the first referendum campaign to take rights away from gays, and they won that. And then in the late 70s, what they did is they infiltrated the Republican Party at the precinct level, at the local level, at the school board level, and ultimately took it over from bottom to top. And what we're seeing today is kind of the logical result of 40 years of sexual counter-revolution that was started by ordinary right-wing fundamentalist women.
So let's talk about who these women are. You name them in the book, so let's name them here. Phyllis Schlafly was one of them. Talk about the leaders and who they were and what their motivation was.
So Phyllis Schlafly is the one that many people remember. She had a background in the John Birch Society and the right wing and the Goldwater campaign. But she was pretty much a nothing in the early 70s. She had a couple thousand followers among these right-wing, John Birch Republican women. But what happened when she started writing about the Equal Rights Amendment, the word got out to the South to fundamentalist women who basically freaked out about the idea of women's equality, of women being in the workforce, of women not being home taking care of their children. That's when this movement got legs. And one of the key leaders, who's really unknown, was this woman named Lottie Beth Hobbs, who was a middle-aged woman who made her living teaching church and writing books for Christian ladies. And she was a member of a church that actually forbid women to teach men. She wrote really the kind of Magna Carta of the anti-feminist movement, what was called the Pink Sheet, where she said God created women with certain privileges and those crazy feminists want to take your privileges away.
So you've given us the sort of synopsis of it, and we know that that evolved into some other documents and campaigns, and then there seemed to have been a coalition that was built.
It was really these church women, particularly women in the Churches of Christ and also Mormon women, who organized in their churches to get a kind of mass movement for this. Schlafly played a role by being their leader, teaching them communications, teaching them how to lobby, teaching them what color to wear on TV. In the late 70s, what happened is a kind of intellectuals of the new right got wind of these movements in the States. And they saw that they could make a profitable alliance because they actually had no voters who supported, you know, ending Social Security and all these laws of ALEC, for example. The founder of that, Paul Weyrich, was the person who first saw these fundamentalist women and first made an alliance. So they formed this pro-family coalition. Reagan's campaign got wind of it and realized that their Southern strategy would have to include not just race, but also religion. And that's how the religious right came on to Reagan's campaign. What happened in the early years, really the new right leaders, the moneyed leaders, were really in control, and they threw a few bones to these sexual fundamentalists, but they really didn't meet many of the promises that they had made to them. Everything shifted in the 90s. The tables turned. These people that had been kind of used by the new right actually took control of the right and took control of the Republican Party.
So if we were going to back up and look at the various key points in history, one of the ones that you think is most important is the birth control pill. Why?
So what the pill did is it gave women control over their sexuality for the first time in human history, really. And in doing that, it also gave women control over their economic life because women could now have sex, have children when they wanted to, stop having children when they were ready, and prepare for a career. One of the most fascinating pieces of research I came across was by two economists who showed that there is actually a causal connection between the pill being available to college-age women and women pursuing college and graduate careers. So really, it's very difficult to imagine how women would have even close to the economic parity we have today if it weren't for women being able to control their sexuality, leaving aside all the, you know, issues of principle and philosophy and American freedom that
just
women
the
should.
Pragmatic
yes.
issues, right.
Yes.
This then had a bit of a backlash as well.
Yes. The sexual revolution gave a particular color to the women's rights movement of the 60s, because it was the first time in the history of women's movements that you really have the ability for sexual freedom coming together with all the other issues that matter for women's rights. All of this together really outraged religious fundamentalists, both Protestant fundamentalists and also religions that take their dictates from an authority and teach that women should be submissive to men. So particularly Orthodox Catholicism and Mormonism. So those were the three groups that were involved in this sexual counter-revolution from the early days, still the case. It really was about this idea they had, and I don't know how to say it in any other way, that sex was destroying America.
One of the parts I enjoyed most about the book was the section where you talked about the history of birth control and the laws around it. When did birth control become a constitutional right, and how?
It became a constitutional right for married couples in 1965, and it was extended to all people, single people as well. I believe the case was 1974. Laws against birth control started being passed in the late 19th century in the Victorian era. Actually, the Connecticut law that was overturned in 1965 by Griswold versus Connecticut was written by P.T. Barnum. So that's just one of those weird historical facts.
And well, he did like circuses.
the laws that made their way to the Supreme Court, it's important to realize that these came out of Connecticut and Massachusetts, not out of Mississippi and Alabama. That Massachusetts still had a law on its book titled Crimes Against Chastity in 1968. When I was writing this book, I myself was surprised at how recent these changes were. And I realized that a lot of women that I would be writing the book for and a lot of the young men I would be writing the book for probably didn't know this history. And so I felt it was important to see how actually revolutionary the sexual revolution was for us to understand why we've gone into this delirium in our politics over sex and birth control and transvaginal probes and gays.
The other part I thought was really fascinating was the difference between before civil rights for the genders as well as for the races and after, and how the law has changed with regards to sexual violence, the impact that the civil rights era has had. Could you trace that for us?
Before the civil rights law of 1964, and then a lot of the laws of the 70s, it was perfectly legal to discriminate against women in employment, and the want ads were actually sex segregated. It was perfectly legal for a husband to rape his wife. Those laws just changed in the 70s. So the law treated women as second-class citizens without full legal protections. Women were not allowed to serve on juries in certain states. Even if a woman was being tried, she wasn't being tried by a jury of her peers because women were excluded.
All men.
Yes. The changes occurred when women's rights activists actually very smartly inserted women's rights into the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and kind of tricked people who thought it would be a poison pill for the whole Civil Rights Act into adopting it. And then through a lot of legal cases, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was one of the pioneering lawyers in overturning a lot of these discriminatory laws. And then a lot of movement building, you know, for example, to win legal abortion. And so by the end of the 70s, everything had really changed.
The other nice to hear it again phrase was the personal is political. And I say that partly because it extends beyond just feminism, that the personal is political, and people don't realize how true that is. But it was good to have you revisit it and how it actually applies.
This is a phrase that arose in the feminist movement of the 70s, but it really applies to everyone, and it applies particularly to gays, because one thing I forgot to mention as we were just talking about this is that every state in the nation had laws against sodomy on its books in the 1960s. By the end of the 1970s, about half the states had eliminated those laws, and interestingly, the federal government had eliminated discrimination against gays in every area except in the military. You know, that's how we ended up with this battle over don't ask, don't tell. But it was actually quite recently that the government stopped discriminating in every other federal agency. What's more important than your ability to have control over your own body, to not have the police break into your house and arrest you because you're having sex with someone of the same sex? I mean, that happened in the early 2000s. Mainstream America really does care most about the economy, but they don't want to go backward on what we consider no-brainers about women's rights and women's equality and fairness toward gays and lesbians.
You wrote about important players on both sides of the aisle, labor unions, for example, and how they played a role in this entire process of the sexual politics.
Yeah, so let's talk about labor unions. So the sexual counter-revolution was a bipartisan affair. It occurred within the Democratic Party as well, and it's played a large role in the Democrats' continuing divisions, their paralysis when they're in power, and their overreaction when they're out of power. What happened in 1972 in the first open primary ever in the Democratic Party, also the first time that 18-year-olds could vote, is that women and young people, small number of gays and kind of black activists organized to win seats at the Democratic convention, and they supported McGovern. The old power brokers and kingpins in the party were outraged, one, that they didn't win these delegate seats, and that, as they put it, their party had been taken over, had been hijacked. So George Meany, the most powerful man in the U.S. who wasn't an elected official and who was the head of the AFL-CIO, said of the New Democrats, "The Democratic Party has been taken over by abortionists, boys who want to marry boys, girls who want to marry girls," and he refused to support George McGovern. It's the only time since the New Deal that Labor hasn't supported the Democratic presidential candidate. And there were some other old reactionaries in the party on these sex and gender issues. Now, remind you, Meany was one of the most liberal men in the country. He played a large role in passing civil rights. He played a large role in passing Medicare. I do have sympathy for the reaction of the time, and we particularly saw it among older ethnic whites. That part passed fairly quickly in the Democratic Party, in part because most of the people who shared that views were Southern fundamentalists who had already moved into the Republican Party on racial issues. And the other ones, like Meany, died, you know, by the time we got to the 80s. But the legacy they left is this idea that Democrats lose by being socially progressive, that standing strong on feminism and gay rights is a losing proposition with so-called mainstream America. Now, if they were right, then you'd have to acknowledge that. The fact is that all the facts show that that's absolutely wrong, and the reverse is the case. The Democrats win elections because they are socially progressive. They've picked up millions of former Republicans on the issues, particularly of women's rights.
Has that been the case over the last few decades, or is that only current?
That very clear shift as of 1992, and it was already starting to show in the 70s with the college educated.
I ask that because exit polls, when the elections came down and the Republican Revolution occurred, and even after that, when the exit polls were done, people said straight out, "I voted on family values." And that was code for "I was voting against gay marriage."
So a couple things. One is the 2004 election, that so-called values voters. Within days, that exit poll was determined by all credible pollsters to have been deeply flawed, because the only question for a Republican to answer was values voter. And the pollsters and the political scientists have absolutely determined and absolutely agree that George Bush won on security and terrorism. There was no shift in the vote on so-called values. The exit polls, these are raw numbers that haven't been put through statistical analysis, haven't been put through regressions. Basically, when you analyze these numbers, there's lots of polling and you can tell why people voted. And many political scientists have shown that this idea that the white working class has left over cultural issues is not true.
You had a whole chapter that dealt with Carter and Reagan. Carter was particularly interesting. Everybody knew he was a religious man. Everybody knew more or less his positions. You tie that in with then the Reagan Revolution.
Jimmy Carter was a transitional figure in a lot of ways. One was on the issue of the White South and religion. So it wasn't yet clear in the mid-70s that the White South was lost for the Democratic Party. And it absolutely left over race initially, but then conservative religion bolstered it. About half of the fundamentalists in the country are very conservative. About a quarter are progressive and a quarter don't vote. And Jimmy Carter fell on most issues in that progressive quarter. But he in some ways got blindsided by these issues of women's rights and gay rights and abortion. He wasn't prepared for it. And so he thought that he could have his Southern fundamentalists and his feminists in the same coalition. And so it was during his presidency that those issues came to a head, in part because the right-wingers forced them to a head. So that's where he's a transitional figure on the South. He was also a transitional figure in turning the Democratic Party in a more conservative direction, but in a not successful way. He alienated the Northern liberals in the party in many ways over lots of other issues, you know, healthcare. And so Ted Kennedy launched a very damaging primary campaign against Carter, from which he never recovered. But the economy was terrible, and the hostages were still held in Iran. Everybody pretty much agrees that it was a throw-the-bum-out election, not some conservative revolution. Reagan only won with a little bit more than 50% of the vote, but he won by bringing the religious right into his administration. And although he didn't give them much power, he did give them power over family policy and women's issues. With Reagan, we get the first moves toward restrictions on abortion, restrictions on international funding over abortion, and that kind of thing.
One other person I'm going to ask you about, and then let's talk more about the overall big picture and what we're seeing today. And that is, you had just a little paragraph, maybe a page, on David Brock.
Yes. Really interesting figure. He played a huge role in the Clinton scandals by publishing the Troopergate article, which was just a pack of lies that everybody agreed. But he really kind of lit up the right wing and the fundamentalists with those allegations against Clinton and also against Hillary as well. He realized that he was not being a reputable journalist when he started going back to do research about his first book about Anita Hill and realizing that he had been played by Clarence Thomas's people. And he had been contracted to write a hit piece on Hillary timed for the 1996 election, and he realized he couldn't do it again. The other thing, Brock was gay, and he was outed. He became very famous in the midst of all this, and I forget the circumstances under which he was outed, but once he was, he discovered what the people he had been associating with were really like. They were really awful to him. He was a leading writer of the right through the first term of the Clinton administration, and now he is the head of Media Matters.
Right. Your general theme, I think I took a quote right out of your book, the sexual counter-revolution helped to destroy both political parties, polarized America. You said it has distorted politics, distracted us from priorities, broken government institutions, and denied opportunity and liberty to many Americans. That's a lot.
It is, and it's all true. I don't think this is the only cause of our political dysfunction today, but I do want to emphasize that it is one of the central ones. And until we recognize it, we are actually not going to be able to fix our broken politics. And we will keep being convinced that, oh, these women's issues, these gay issues, oh, they're just a sideline. We really shouldn't talk about them much. We should focus on what's really important. And the right wing takes power again because that is, in fact, what they care about. They do want to go back to pre-sexual revolution. They want women back in the home. They want to stop unmarried people from having sex. They want to put gays back into second-class citizenship. Now, that's unacceptable to the 80% of America who doesn't agree with them. These people constitute only 15 to 20% of the electorate, surprisingly, but they have a lot of power because of their political savvy. No one thinks that one of the world's powers should be debating whether birth control is legal.
It has affected policies that are really important. And one of the key examples you gave was when there was a debate going on about funding the troops while they were in Afghanistan and Iraq. And many would say we should have just pulled them out anyway. Most of our listeners would agree with that. But instead of taking up that debate, they held up the vote in order to destroy Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the repeal of it.
They actually attached a rider to this funding bill that they would not pass the funding unless Don't Ask, Don't Tell was taken out of it. And that's how we ended up with Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal as a separate standalone item. But still, the Republicans claim the Tea Party was about the jobs, and they spent the year introducing 1,100 pieces of legislation around the country to restrict abortion. They practically shut down the government over funding for Planned Parenthood less than 100 days after they took office. They're so single-minded about taking away women's rights and carrying on about sexual issues that they're really letting fundamental issues that this country needs to face languish.
Did you get a sense in your research about how much that was occurring, how many major pieces of legislation got distracted?
I saw a few big pieces of legislation that this affected. So, for example, the United States would have had a very well-funded universal child care in the 70s if these women hadn't organized against federally funded childcare. And this is a case where the Democrats got so scared that they never brought this back up again in a really pure form. That's how we got all these ridiculous child tax credits that really don't help working people, because these Republican women killed this so early and Democrats became so afraid to bring it up. Another case is DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act. About five or six of these Christian right sexual fundamentalist organizations introduced it in the Iowa caucus in 1996 and forced all of the Republican candidates to take a position on it, which then brought it to Congress. And then it was the year that Clinton was running really scared, and he signed DOMA in the middle of the night. George Bush's first veto was on stem cell research. He hadn't bothered to veto anything for, I think it was 5 years, until the stem cell research bill came up.
You think it's only a small percentage of people that actually support this. Why is it playing such a massive role?
Because the small minority who supports it are all Republicans. They're all Republican activists. And they make up anywhere from 40 to 60% of Republican voters, depending on what state you're in. It's probably about 45% nationwide. The Republican obsession with birth control and gays and abortion and transvaginal probes and sluts is actually a logical result of the fact of who has the power in the Republican Party. And the people who have the power are the sexual fundamentalists. They're close to half of the vote in the Republican primary. They're the ones who have run all the moderates out of the party. So the Republican Party doesn't necessarily agree with it, but they're held hostage.
You mentioned very early on that the women who began this counter-revolution did belong to a couple of specific churches. One was the Mormon Church. Do you think that it has changed at all in its positions, or is it still the same as it was back when the Pink Sheet was written?
I think it's more or less the same. The Mormon Church was the only official church in the United States to take a stand against the Equal Rights Amendment. They actually excommunicated women who supported the Equal Rights Amendment.
Given your analysis that this counter-revolutionary fundamentalist group has pushed out the moderates of the Republican Party and moved it so far to the right, and given the up-and-coming young people who are generally not so fundamentalist in their beliefs either about sexuality and certainly not on the gay issues, not to the extreme that we're seeing, do you predict that the Republican Party will either fall apart down the road with young people, or do you predict that it will have to morph back into something that accounts for the younger generation's beliefs?
It's hard to know how many years they have left on this track. This is, I do think, the last gasp of the people that support this are over 65, demographically unrepresentative. Ultimately, because America's constitutional system favors two parties and makes it very difficult to have any less or any more than two parties, the Republican Party will have to change and will have to make itself acceptable to the mainstream of America.
Thank you so much, Nancy Cohen. The book is called Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America.
Thank you, Maria.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.